And we have somebody who has signed up on House Bill 2020 today. Is Doug Smith still here? Yep. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2020 and have Doug come on up.
Well, thank you for allowing me to interrupt 2003. Of the two bills that I've studied, 2008 and 2020, benefit contribution type of bill, which is 2020, seems superior to 2008. It allows money to go into a pot and then is invested by the Oregon Investment Council. In fact, it's the complete variable type of benefit plan as PERS is now. Howsoever, there is one problem with both bills, and that is Section 19, which says deals with contract rights. As I read the, as I read Section 19 of the bills, it says that. That the legislature can change the benefits. It appears to be arbitrarily that they could, in fact, take away all the benefits. As I read contract rights, it seems like there are no rights. I don't know if that's my correct reading or not.
No, I think you're correct in reading that.
Even if there are, some people like Bob Tiernan and Sizemore's and Leon Parks, the retirees may literally have all their benefits taken away. So it would seem like, at least, I'm a member of PERS retirees, but I don't speak for them. It would appear that the various bills floating around here, 2020 without Section 19 would be the preferred bill for retirees. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Doug. We have questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in. Anyone else wishing to testify on 2020? Close public hearing on House Bill 2020. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2008. I don't think we were going to hear from the employer and employee groups today. They were still working on numbers. That's correct. We have heads shaking. Anybody else want to testify on House Bill 2008? Seeing no one else, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2008. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2003. And did our presenters flip to see who wanted to go first? Bill, did you want to go first? You want to go first and last, right? You want to open and you want to close. Well, come on up. I think we've got about a half hour allotted for the pro and the con side, and then I'm sure the committee will have questions, so we'll probably have questions at the and let's have questions at the end, just so we don't make sure that everybody gets an equal amount of time on this. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Gary. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Harang Long Gary Rudnick. Seated to my right is Mr. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. What we plan to do today with the time allotted is to focus on two main aspects of the bill, the section of the bill that's been referred to as the Lipscomb adjustment relating to the Marion County lawsuit, and the section dealing with the elimination of employee contributions. I plan to talk about both of those in somewhat greater detail than I did when you invited me on February 11th to preview this bill, and then Jim Green will talk about some of the fiscal impacts associated with the proposal. I have submitted written testimony and attached to it so that we get it in the record of this bill, the written testimony that I submitted for you back in February. And in that submission, I laid out the economic situation relating to the public employees retirement system, which I know that the members of this committee are painfully aware of. And so I will start by talking about the lawsuit that was brought by a number of participating employers, seven employers, all local governments: Eugene, Cortland, Multnomah County, Lane County, City of Roseburg, City of Huntington, from the Canby Utility District, in Marion County Circuit Court. When that lawsuit was filed in 1998, we initially challenged the rate orders that had been issued by the PERS Board in 1998. As these things go, it took some time to slog through the very complex issues that were raised in the case, and we had the opportunity to amend our complaint to add a challenge to the board's distribution of income from the fund for 1999, an order that was entered in 2000. And we also had the opportunity to add a challenge to the 2000 rate order that was entered. So there were actually three orders before the court when we finally got through the trial and Judge Lipscomb issued his decision. In a nutshell, the judge concluded that in several significant ways, the PERS board had been violating the statutes that it's charged with administering, in ways that both increased benefits beyond those that are provided by law and which correspondingly increased the cost of the system to the employers and the taxpayers. The errors that the judge identified, and obviously I'm going to simplify this for the sake of brevity, but they fall into three main categories. Probably the most significant and certainly the most long-lasting of the errors, that is, have been going on for the longest period of time, dealt with the way that the PERS board credited income. And what the judge found is that in about three different ways, the PERS board's practice of crediting income, in particular to Tier 1 employees, was contrary to the statutes. In the first place, statutes that have been in existence for decades provide that the PERS board out of income is first required to set aside up to 7.5% of the earnings in any particular year to a contingency reserve account. The PERS board discontinued its practice of maintaining a contingency reserve account in 1978, and the judge found that it was error for the board to fail to fund a contingency reserve account in the years that followed. Obviously, the board has discretion as to how much they put into that account up to the cap of 7.5% of earnings, but the judge said the board did not have discretion to disregard the direction from this body to maintain such an account. Secondly, the court found that a fairly, I think everybody would agree, fairly difficult to fathom statute, ORS 238.670(2), which deals with the what's referred to as the benefits in force reserve, the reserves that the board maintains to make sure that there's enough money to pay benefits to people that are already retired, that the board had not been properly following that statute in the manner that it allocated income to the benefits in force reserve. And perhaps most significantly, after a three-week trial that we spent quite a bit of time with actuaries talking about how the board allocates income to Tier 1 accounts in the light of a guaranteed earnings rate, guaranteeing Tier 1 members the assumed earnings rate, the judge found that the board in 1999 abused its discretion by allocating 20% of the almost 24% that the PERS fund earned that year to Tier 1 accounts, 12% above the guaranteed rate of return. The judge's reasoning in that was that, first of all, it was an abuse of discretion to pay more than 8% to Tier 1 members when the board had failed to set aside a contingency reserve and had failed to follow its own policy, which at the time provided that the board should set aside enough money to have 30 months of crediting of 8% to Tier 1 accounts. But the court went beyond that and said it simply is imprudent to the point of being an abuse of discretion for the PERS board to credit 20% in years when the board, when the fund earns more than 8%, recognizing that the assumption is that over time the board will earn 8%, and knowing, as the board must, that if that assumption proves true, every percentage point that they pay above 8% is necessarily coming out of the pockets of the taxpayers. The second thing that the court addressed beyond income crediting is the actuarial tables. I won't say anything more about that. You're very familiar with the issue of actuarial tables, except to note that unlike House Bill 2004, which this committee passed and the House passed and is now in the Senate, Judge Lipscomb told the board that current law requires the board to implement actuarial tables immediately and fully. And that was his ruling as to what the law today provides. And finally, the court found that the PERS board had been improperly calculating benefits for those members who retired with money in the variable by failing to do an adjustment as provided by statute, the effect of which is that PERS practice is that employers are required to match the increased gain that members receive by participation in the variable, when, according to Judge Lipscomb, the legislature's clear intent was that employers would only be required to match what would have been in a member's account had he been invested in the regular account. Those were the total, in summary form, is what Judge Lipscomb found had been wrong. Most of those practices had been going on for a very long time, and however, because the challenges were not brought until the 1998 rate orders, it's at least our position that as far back as you can go to correct those errors is to 1996, which was the last rate order that employers could have but did not challenge. And so when we turn to House Bill 2003, that will be a critical date, 1996, because of the how far back do you go to address these problems. Using that as the benchmark, the PERS actuary, Mr. Johnson, has estimated that the cost of the errors identified in Judge Lipscomb's opinion on a projected basis is something in the neighborhood of $3 billion. It's actually a little bit north of $3 billion, working off of a estimated unfunded actuarial liability of $15 billion. That's about 20% of the total unfunded actuarial liability. Now, this was a proceeding under the Administrative Procedures Act, and what that means is that the court's remedy was somewhat limited by the statute. It was not the court's job to tell PERS how to fix this, and so what the judge did was take the three orders that we had appealed and vacated them to the PERS board with directions to the PERS board to follow the law as it had been given to it by the court. And the only real direction, I think, other than to follow the law that Judge Lipscomb gave them was that under the statute they do not have the authority to charge the employers for the cost of these errors, that is the petitioning employers at least. Now, I know Mr. Hartman will tell you that this was only seven employers and it really doesn't have that much impact because none of the other employers challenged the order. And that's true on a technical basis in part, and it's false in part. It's true in that as to the rates that were challenged, Only the seven employers who challenged the rates are entitled to the relief by the court, because the other people chose, other employers chose not to bring an action. And when PERS calculates rates, they send out individual orders to each of the 1,500 or so participating PERS employers. And so each employer has to make a choice. With respect to the 1999 earnings allocation, however, the order was simply an order directed to everybody that said, here's how we're going to allocate income within the fund. And when Judge Lipscomb set that aside, of course, that means that the allocation of 1999 earnings throughout the fund must be redone. But as a practical matter, the fact that there were only seven petitioning employers is really a matter of little or no moment, because we are not dealing with a cost of the system that is static. Every 2 years, the PERS board sends out orders. We trust and expect that, assuming that Judge Lipscomb's order is upheld, the PERS board will follow it, and it will follow it with respect to all participating employers, as I'm sure we all would expect it to do. Even if it doesn't, any participating employer whose rates are not calculated based upon Judge Lipscomb's ruling could file a lawsuit the next day, and it would be a fairly easy matter, unlike the lawsuit that we just finished, to get an order saying that they're entitled to the same result as the seven petitioning employers receive. And so that's where we stand today. The judgment has been entered as to my client's claims. There's some procedural difficulties in getting the case up to the appellate court, but I am confident that eventually the appellate court will review this and will grade Judge Lipscomb's report card, and I'm sure Mr. Hartman will tell you he's confident that the judge will be reversed, and so I will say for the record I'm confident that he will be affirmed. Of course, none of us know. House Bill 2003 proposes a remedy for the errors that were identified by Judge Lipscomb. And I want to take a moment to explain to you why the bill proposes the remedy rather than leaving this for the courts to sort out. There really are two reasons. The first is that, as I've mentioned, the judge's decision did not tell PERS how to solve this problem. It merely told it to solve this problem. PERS has very limited capacity to address this issue. PERS is a closed system. It has three different sources of money. It can get the money, the $3 billion, by increasing employer contribution rates, which we would argue is the one source of money that Judge Lipscomb told them is not available to them. It could get a influx of money from the legislature, I suppose, if you had an extra $3 billion hanging around that you wanted to throw at the problem, or it can pay for the costs out of future earnings. That's the only place where money comes into the fund, those three places. And, of course, employee contributions as well, which are fixed by statute. That puts PERS in a difficult position, which almost without doubt would send them to this body for advice and counsel and assistance as to what they should do in the event that this judgment is affirmed and implemented. There is one other source of money, of course, which is to go into the accounts or the benefits of the PERS members who have received excessive benefits under the judge's decision. Governor Kulongoski, in his statement of principles, said that he wanted a solution to the problem that would not take money out of the accounts of people who have already retired and that would not reduce the account balances of other PERS members. That is not likely to be the outcome if this case is left for implementation by the PERS board because of the limited options that they will have. And so House Bill 2003 proposes a remedy that that avoids reaching into retiree accounts, avoids touching the account balances of members, and more importantly, I think, or at least as important, House Bill 2003 provides that remedy today as opposed to 3 years from now or perhaps even longer. Employers need the relief today, this would produce savings in this biennium, and equally important, members need the certainty of knowing what their PERS benefits will be. We cannot, in good conscience, allow the uncertainty to continue and the drain of financial resources, as identified by the court, to continue for another 3 years. So House Bill 2003 provides a mechanism whereby the legislature can step in and say, this is the way that Judge Lipscomb's ruling should be implemented. And it does it in what is a fairly creative and, in some respects, I think, difficult to fathom mechanism, and that's the creation of a deficit account within PERS. If the number of the identified errors, the cost of those errors, is set at $3 billion, under House Bill 2003, there would be a deficit account of $3 billion. And the that account would be slowly paid off out of future income for, to the PERS fund. Because the assumed earnings rate that the actuary assumes is an assumed rate net of expenses, one effect of creating this deficit account is that, according to the actuary, it would probably cause him to reduce his estimate of assumed earnings to about 7%. That has the effect of reducing the growth of member accounts. It also would provide a source of money other than employer contributions to pay for these costs that the court has said should not be charged to employers. I'm going to take just a minute to talk about one other issue on which I suspect there may be questions from the committee concerning the Lipscomb adjustment. And that is whether it's fair. Given the fact that we're talking about benefits that will be paid to people that have already retired or are going to retire sometime in the next 5 years that are, according to the court, unlawfully inflated by virtue of errors made by the PERS board, is it fair to pay for the cost of those errors out of future earnings? One way of looking at it is that it really balances the mistakes of the past on the newest and youngest members of the system who will be in the system for the longest. And I think that's a fair and debatable point, and one that I would commend to this committee to consider. It is, I think, the only solution that produces savings, addresses the problems identified by Judge Lipscomb in his decision, and does not touch retiree accounts and does not reduce member accounts. But in the final analysis, that's really a question of fairness that this body must wrestle with. And as I said, I think it is the alternative to a result that is inconsistent with the governor's standards that is likely to obtain if the litigation just plays itself out. Also, I want to point out that it is important that you look at this provision in conjunction with the other provisions of the bill, and in particular the 6% solution that I'm going to turn to in a minute, because one of the effects of reducing the or eliminating the requirement that employees make a contribution to the fund is that there will not be, for new members coming into the system, employee accounts at all. And for members who are probably less than 10 years in the system, certainly less than 5 years in the system, their account balances without the additional contributions coming from the members will never grow to the point where it triggers the money match. And so while at first blush it appears that we're asking the newest employees to pay for the errors of the PERS board that benefited the oldest employees, in fact, with a comprehensive solution such as House Bill 2003, the newest employees will not be affected because they will be retiring under the full formula and their account balance will not be a factor in the calculation of that benefit. And so earnings crediting on account balances becomes less significant than it does in a money match environment. Let me turn then to the provisions in the bill that, as it's drafted today, over the course of the coming biennium, would eliminate the requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income to the retirement fund. I want to try to explain about three things about this proposal that I think are pretty widely misunderstood. I want to first take some time to explain why it works and why it produces significant savings over time. And then I want to talk about the impacts that it would have on members. And while this is something that is certainly worthy of greater study in looking at modeling from the actuary to see projected impacts on members, I can give you an idea of how the burden would fall typically. And then I want to talk just briefly about the difference between this proposal eliminating the employee contribution and what some people, including my colleague Mr. Hartman, have characterized it as, which is eliminating the pickup, which is not what it does. The reason that the 6%, eliminating the 6% contribution produces savings and in a fundamental way puts the PERS system back on the course that it was always intended to be on is because of what I think of as the accident of money match. You all know that something like 95% of all PERS members today are retiring and are expected to retire under the money match benefit. As I mentioned on February 11th, it was never intended to be so. And some people will tell you, well, the benefit's been there since 1953. It's the oldest benefit. They neglect to point out that it was eliminated by this body in 1967 and replaced with the pension plus annuity. And in 1969, it was reinserted by this body solely for the purpose of protecting the interests of those few members who had been in the system for a very long time and who would actually receive higher benefits under the money match benefit than they would receive under the pension plus annuity. And when the legislature put it back into the system in 1969, they did not put it in the same form that it was in prior to 1967. Prior to 1967, the law provided that employees would contribute X percent of their income and employers would match that amount. They were matching the contribution. They were not matching the accumulated earnings as the money match does. I think it's fair to say that in 1969 the legislature was led to make an understandable but unfortunate mistake by not qualifying the money match as I think they intended it to be, to grandfather in certain long-term members. And so for the next 25 years, the money match provision sat dormant in the statutes. The PERS actuary has testified that he didn't even consider the effect of the money match in calculating the cost of the system until 1995. He assumed that everybody would be retiring under the full formula, and I would submit to you that's what this body intended, and that's what this body always assumed as well. The reason that that's significant is because, as I've mentioned before, when you're analyzing what the contract is, the question is not what's in the statute. The question is what did the legislature intend to promise? And I submit to you that the legislature never intended to promise that people who joined the system after 1969 would be entitled to receive a money match benefit. There's no question it's there, and there's no question that as long as it's there, people are entitled to receive it. But the fundamental question is, can the legislature change it? And I believe that the legislature, should it choose to do so, could eliminate the money match and could eliminate it as to people who are in the system today. Now, why haven't we proposed that? We haven't proposed it because it wouldn't be fair, because there are a great many people who have come to rely upon the projections that PERS has given them over the years that money match benefit would be available to them. And so we come to the 6% solution as an alternative. Rather than eliminating the money match benefit on a retroactive basis for everybody, This bill proposes to gradually scale back the impact of the money match by eliminating the requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income to the PERS fund. The reason that will scale back the impact of the money match is because the accounts will grow less quickly than they do when they're contributing 6% of their income. And as a result, over time, if House Bill 2003 becomes law, PERS will become what it was always intended, at least since 1981, to be, which is a defined benefit plan. Under this bill, no one will ever retire at less than the full formula benefit. And most PERS Tier 1, all PERS Tier 1 members probably, and most PERS Tier 2 members will still retire under the money match, but the money match benefit will produce a less robust enhancement of the full formula than would happen if there were no change made. The reason it works that way, as I've said, is because it slows the growth of member accounts, and so the impact that it has on members is actually quite finely tuned to where a person is in their career. Someone who is a year away from retirement will have a fairly significant large account balance. The 6% of their income will represent less, significantly less, growth to their account than will the earnings on that fund. Just as we all hope that our 401k will eventually get to the point where our contributions are not as great as our earnings on the 401k. And so for people that are close to retirement, the elimination of the 6% will have very little impact on their benefit. For somebody that retires immediately, it will have none. As you move back in time, and with less and less experience, the impact will be greater. Somebody who has 10 years of service in is likely still to retire under the money match benefit if this bill passes after a full career, but will retire at something much less than they would have retired in terms of a replacement ratio had you done nothing. And for people that are less than 10 years away from or in the system, it probably means that their account balance will never grow to the size that it would need to be to trigger the money match. And so the 6% proposal scales back the impact of the money match in a way that I think very closely mirrors the settled expectations of the PERS members. The closer you are to retirement, the less impact it will have on you. The further away you are from retirement, and therefore the further away you are from having made retirement plans, and the more time you have to adjust your plans, the greater the impact will be. Now,
Bill, you're getting close to your half hour.
And I'm very close to being done, too. Thank you. Eliminating the employer contribution does not equate to eliminating the requirement that employers pick up the contribution. As you know, many employers, including the state of Oregon, but not all employers, have agreed pursuant to statute that they will pay the employee contribution of the member. And that was an agreement, the product of agreements that when they were made were really win-win situations for both the employees and the employer, because by the employer agreeing to contribute on behalf of the employee, they undoubtedly gave less in raises at that time than they might otherwise have done, and the employer is able to save the other payroll expenses associated with paying increased incomes. So that was the deal, and I don't think there's any real dispute that was the reason for the provision of the pickup. And there's also no dispute that the Supreme Court held in the OSPOA case by the narrowest of margins, a 4-3 vote, that an employer, having once agreed to pick up that contribution, could not turn around and say, you know what, new deal, I'm not going to pick up that contribution. But the reason that case is different from the situation here is because this bill does not propose that employers will stop paying the 6%. It eliminates the requirement that anybody pay an employee contribution. The employer would assume 100% of the costs of the retirement plan. And in normal contract parlance, this legislature's decision to eliminate the requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income would be characterized as a change in circumstances that occasions a need for people to sit down and talk about what are we going to do in light of the fact that this requirement is no longer there. And there are many options that would be available, including setting up a side-by-side defined contribution plan or some sort of a health plan that would allow members to continue to shelter that 6% but not put it into the PERS fund. The reason that that's significant is because the taxpayers pay a dollar in salary to a member, and when that member takes that dollar and puts it in the PERS fund, it costs an additional $2, costs an additional $1.60. And so the question is, do you want to pay a dollar or do you want to pay $2.60? That's why that proposal produces savings. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. I think I'm going to wait till questions and until Greg comes up, if that's okay with the committee. So that way we can give him an equal amount of time, because I don't know how many questions we could burn through here in the next 15 to 20 minutes.
I realized when you told me that my 30 minutes was almost up that you were also talking about Mr. Green's 30 minutes. I wonder if you might indulge him with just a few minutes.
Jim, did you have something
Mr.
to add?
Members of the committee, yes, just a couple of moments. I don't need 30 minutes. I promised the committee that. Just a couple of minutes to put some numbers on what some of the parts that Mr. Gary just spoke about, particularly the elimination of the 6% contribution. Currently, if you take a look at the PERS system, and these are numbers that the actuary has shared with you and everyone else around the world, I believe, as of December 2001, the unfunded actuarial liability that the entire system had, and remember, this is December 31, 2001, was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $5.6 billion. We all know that number has grown dramatically. If by enacting 2003, and particularly eliminating the 6% contribution, you can reduce that unfunded actuarial liability by about $2 billion. And when the actuary goes to figure out an employer's contribution rate, he takes the normal cost rate of what it would take to fund the system, and then he also throws in the health care insurance part, and then he also has amortized into part of that the unfunded actuarial liability, because employers need to pay for that. In the rates for 2001, he estimated, Mark Johnson, the actuary, that the normal cost rate for the system was about 10.52 for every employer across the system. And to amortize the UAL, that $5.6 billion as of December 31st, an additional $5.28 was put on top of that. So just to pay that $5.6 billion, we had to pay an additional 5.28% in our rates. That's a huge increase. For an example, the people that I represent, school districts, at the 1999 valuation, our unfunded actuarial liability for school districts, just for the 198 school districts and 21 ESDs, was at $680 million. That is a huge number. However, in December 31, 2001, our unfunded actuarial liability went to $2.5 billion for school districts and ESDs alone. By eliminating the ability for a 6% contribution and reducing the unfunded actuarial liability by $2 billion, you're going to save school districts, education service districts, not to mention the state and other employers across the state that are PERS members, significant amounts of money. We are paying back the unfunded actuarial liability over time to PERS at 8%. And if you take a look at projections that PERS has used themselves in saying, what happens if we have earnings on the fund from now until 2007 to the unfunded actuarial liability? They did a graduated scale earnings of about 4%, constant earnings each year, 4% to 12%. And even if it earned 4% from now until 2007, that unfunded actuarial liability grows to over $20 billion. And if we, by happenstance, and got really lucky and earned 12% every year till 2007, it would grow to $2.4 billion. Even if we have earnings in excess of the 8% assumed earnings guarantee, we are still going to have an unfunded actuarial liability. We realize that. Even with 2003, we would have that. But you can reduce the unfunded actuarial liability by $2 billion by simply eliminating that. And I think Mr. Gary told you why, is because of the money match situation. You can reduce rates. You can have current savings. you can have school districts, education service districts, and local government employers across the state in a time when they're trying to balance their budgets, and some of them don't even know what their budget's going to be for the next biennium, you can help them on their cost side by eliminating that contribution and reducing that unfunded actuarial liability by $2 billion. That's a dramatic cost savings to school districts and employers.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll get you back up here for questions after Greg Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm here representing the Purse Coalition. And I guess I should just get to it right away and say I don't necessarily agree with everything that Mr. Gary just said. I'd like to start with a couple of preliminary observations. First of all, House Bill 2003 is an extraordinarily complex piece of work, and by no means do I intend to address every aspect of it. I am preparing a more detailed written review, which I will share with the committee as soon as I can get it prepared. But I would urge you that to the extent that you do decide, if you do decide to go forward with any of the portions of this bill, I think this bill really deserves a word-by-word analysis, because it could very well have some unintended consequences, which, as you know, has been a problem from time to time in the PERS system. Like Mr. Gary, I'm just going to talk about a couple of issues, so by no means am I trying to be comprehensive. We believe that the provisions I'm going to talk about today, largely the 6% solution and the adjustment arising out of the Eugene case, would in fact breach members' contract rights. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. I would call your attention to the recent opinion of your legislative counsel, Greg Chamoff, in a letter that he wrote to Senator Tony Corcoran, in which he expressed the opinion quite succinctly that in fact that was the case. And I will simply say I agree with Mr. Chamoff. I think his analysis is very straightforward. There's really all the analysis that need be done on this to reach the conclusion that there is a problem with breach of contract. Let me talk first about the 6% solution, since that's the one that Mr. Gary talked about most recently. I was fascinated to hear him say that he believes this body could simply eliminate money match, because he referred to it as the accident of money match. It's an interesting concept. It's a nice rhetorical touch, but to the extent that it's regarded as an accident, I will leave that as Mr. Gary's characterization, and I would not regard the legislative action in 1969 to be accidental. They simply reinstituted the money match benefit. I also disagree with Mr. Gary's recollection of some of the testimony at trial, but we need not go into that in any great degree. Money match is one of the core benefits of the current PERS program. I don't see there's any way that this legislative body could eliminate it, if you care to do so, without very specifically running afoul of protected contract rights. So I have to disagree with the basic premise that I guess Mr. Gary brings to the table, that is, that this is some kind of accidental benefit and therefore can be eliminated without any great difficulty. It is, in fact, and Mr. Gary's quite upfront about this, it is a method of eventually taking money match out of the system. Over time, money match will disappear as a benefit because there will be no employee accounts, and so over time there simply will be no money match. Now, I could cite many cases that say if you can't do something directly, you also cannot do it indirectly, and I think all of those cases would stand for the proposition that if, in fact, money match is a protected benefit in the system, you can't get rid of it by going in the back door any more than you can get rid of it by going in the front door. And that's really what this proposal does. But I really want to focus for a moment on some other troubling aspects of this proposal, because it is a relatively low cost saver, and it is a relatively high risk proposal. Remember, the analysis from the actuary indicates that the cost savings to employers of implementing the 6% solution by itself, I'm setting it aside from the other parts of the bill, is a savings of 1.19% of payroll. Now, I'm not saying that's not significant, but as we discuss these variety of changes, that's one of the smaller percentages change which is affected by making these changes. You may also have seen the figure 7.19%, that in fact is the employer savings, but that takes place only if the employer is successful in recapturing the 6% contribution, which is either made directly by the participants or alternatively is picked up by many employers. Now, I'm not quite sure how that recapture is going to take place, and it raises some daunting legal issues all by itself. The bill currently calls for a reopener of all collectively bargained contracts. I think that has legal difficulties. But again, I want to remind you that if we set that aside and say, well, we don't know what's going to happen to the 6%, then the total savings are relatively modest. The reason for that is while you eliminate the money match benefit, you also now will be funding the full formula benefit solely on the basis of employer contributions. So there's a very significant trade-off in this bill. It's not just a savings, it's a savings coupled with an increased obligation. Now, the reason that's important is there are winners and losers in this 6% solution. In many of the other proposals, from my perspective, representing those who represent purse participants, there are only losers. But that's not true in this case. Quite frankly, if I were a Tier 2 participant, I would much rather, I can only speak for myself at this point, but I would much rather have a purely funded, defined benefit, full formula, and keep my 6% and stick it in a 401k or put it somewhere else. If I'm partway through my career as a Tier 1 employee and I'm discovering that my money match benefit is going to go away by the time I reach retirement, I'm a loser. Now, the reason that's important is if we think ahead, and Mr. Gary is right, we really, none of us can say for certain how litigation is going to turn out, on all these issues. I'm as confident as he is, but at the end of the day, we'll all get back together and decide who was correct to be confident in a few years when it all gets sorted out. But think about what happens if the court does determine, consistent with Mr. Chamoff's opinion, that this, in fact, is a breach of contract. You may very well have created a system where those Tier 2 people can continue to insist upon the payment of a full formula benefit without their making any contribution, while at the same time the cost savings that you were trying to achieve with Tier 1 may go out the window. I've had this come up in other times when I've dealt with public pension proposals, and I call it the best of both worlds scenario. Of course, that's from my client's point of view. From the point of view of those who are on the other side of the system, they may call it the worst of both worlds scenario. So I want to caution you that as you think about this particular proposal, it really has some very, very unique kinds of properties. And I think that I would characterize it as a low savings, high risk proposal. So if you think that, if you agree with Mr. Gary that money match is somehow accidental and therefore susceptible to being taken out of the system, then this may appeal to you. If, on the other hand, you believe that Mr. Chamoff may know what he's talking about, then I think that you are taking an extraordinary risk for a relatively low savings. I would encourage you not to pursue the 6% solution. I don't think it's going to get you to where you want to go. Let me talk about the second of the two parts I'm going to talk about, and that is the Gene case. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the details of that case. I would probably have some differences in how I would describe the issues from the way Mr. Gary described them, but for the purposes of today's discussion, I'm not going to belabor that point. I think the most important thing, if I may, is to point out that because of the limitations of the Administrative Procedures Act, Judge Lipscomb could only go so far in determining the issues that were in front of him. Now, as a layman, as a non-attorney, of course, the immediate issue was, well, if Judge Lipscomb thought something was wrong, why didn't he tell us how to fix it, which would be a perfectly good question. The answer to that, of course, is the Administrative Procedures Act limited his ability to do that. And so what the judge did was he identified some areas where he believed the PERS board had incorrectly interpreted the law. He identified some areas where he believed the PERS board had abused their discretion, particularly in regard to the 1999 distribution of earnings. And he set aside rate orders. And he sent it back to PERS saying, redo the rate orders, and redo them in light of what I have now told you I believe the statute to mean, and in light of what I've now said about what I believe the limits of your discretion were. Clearly, Judge Lipscomb intended them to do more than simply redo the rate orders. But he did not tell any of us what he believes the proper thing to do. Now, I think that's very important because I think it is entirely inappropriate to describe this bill as the Lipscomb adjustment. I would suggest to you more appropriately, this should be described as the Gary adjustment. Because what it represents, and I mean no offense to Mr. Gary by saying this, what it represents is Mr. Gary attempting to stretch Judge Lipscomb's ruling to the outer possible limits that he can stretch it, and then come to this committee and say, I would suggest that you should implement Judge Lipscomb's order in this fashion. Now, he's purely within his rights to do that. And again, I don't mean to be offensive by calling it the Gary adjustment. But you should understand that's what it is. Judge Lipscomb has not endorsed it. I don't agree that this is what would happen or anything that looks like this if it went back to the PERS board. I think that Mr. Gary has simply come to you and said, we would like the legislature to step into the middle of this process and to make its own adjustment. And this really takes me to the next issue that I want to raise with you, and I have no solution to this issue. I literally spent a half a day with two of my partners on Friday morning trying to figure out the complexities of an existing case such as the Eugene case, which is currently on appeal, and the legislature stepping forward and trying to implement that case in a way that the legislature may think appropriate, and trying to figure out the procedural issues for how this whole work, and I refer to that all of it, is going to go up on appeal, and how the two things interrelate. And let me tell you, it's one of the most complex discussions of the interrelationship between the legislature and the courts and administrative agencies I've ever had. Back in my youth, when I was in law school, I took legislative and administrative procedure from later Justice Hans Lindy, and he would have been proud of us as we discussed the intricacies that come out of this process. Why do I raise this? Because I think you really have to sort through these issues and make a determination on what you're doing. And by that I mean, are you crafting a solution which is dependent on Judge Lipscomb being affirmed? Because if so, then you should go into it knowing that if it does turn out that the judge erred in some significant way, that all or part of your resolution may fall with his opinion. If on the other hand you're saying no, Judge Lipscomb has simply called things to our attention which we as the legislative body feel appropriate to act on, and clearly you can. I mean, I'm not suggesting you don't have the authority to do that. You clearly have that authority. But then I think you need to make independent determinations, independent of Judge Lipscomb, on whether you think this approach to solving what may be a perceived problem is, in fact, the most appropriate approach to deal with it. Otherwise, we end up in a somewhat hopeless morass of trying to figure out whose issues are being appealed, and whether the resolution of one issue, for instance, as I said, is an overturning of some aspect of Judge Lipscomb's decision going to have an impact on this legislative resolution. It's a daunting problem, and I, like I said, after half a day of kind of brainstorming our way through it, I don't have any clear proposal that I can make to you other than I would strongly suggest that this body and the legislative body as you debate this needs to keep that in mind and try to sort through that and determine whether you're acting independently as the legislative body who thinks something needs to be done or whether you are in part dependent on what Judge Lipscomb does or doesn't do or whether Judge Lipscomb does or doesn't get affirmed. I don't think this bill, as currently drafted, does a very good job of keeping those separate. As a matter of fact, in some ways it mixes those, and in ways which I think, again, could cause some very difficult inadvertent consequences. So again, I would urge you, as you go through this process, to think about the interrelationship. Because, you know, it's highly unusual for the legislature to step in halfway through a legal case and implement a solution. More often what the legislature does is they perceive that the judge has erred, at least in their opinion, in the interpretation of a law, and so steps in and cures that by disagreeing with the judge. So it's somewhat unusual to do what Mr. Gary is asking you to do, which is to weigh in essence, with the judge. As I said, it raises some very daunting issues. The Gary solution, the Gary adjustment, does a lot of calculating. It makes a lot of assumptions about how this adjustment should be calculated. Each one of those assumptions is subject to being challenged because, again, this is Mr. Gary's wish in how this would be resolved. And let me just give you one very quick example. Judge Lipscomb ruled that when the legislature instituted the full formula benefit in 1981, that the language that came into the statute at that time limited the money match benefit for those people who participated in the variable account. Question: does that mean that those people who were in the system prior to 1982 and therefore already had a broader money match based on a full match of their variable, do they have a protected interest which could not have been set aside by the 1982 legislature? In other words, did they have a protected contract right? An issue never addressed before Judge Lipscomb, because obviously Judge Lipscomb didn't come anywhere near the implementation phase. But as you go through these various calculations, that's, for instance, a separate issue that would have to be addressed, because if the people who were in the system in 1981 had a protected interest that couldn't be changed, then this calculation is substantially an error. Because I would suggest to you that almost all the people who have retired in the last 4 or 5 years were most likely in the system in 1981. Now, I could go through the other parts of this and talk about the various issues which will arise, but again, we only have a half an hour to enjoy each other's company, and I'm not going to do that. I do want to point out, though, that there are two other things I want to comment on this aspect of the proposal. And again, this is the, and I think Mr. Gary was very upfront as he discussed this, this bill does provide that the group who at least arguably received excess benefits, at least according to Judge Lipscomb's view, are not the people who are going to pay for that error. Under this bill, the people that will pay for that error are those people who are currently in the system and those people who will be in the system in the future. Now, I've referred to that as the robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of approach. But again, I want to call your attention to Mr. Chamoff's opinion, because he makes it very clear that that basic approach is flawed. That, at least in his opinion, that he does not believe that you can, in effect, take the errors of the system in the past, assuming that they are errors, and again, we don't really know that until we complete review in the Supreme Court, and balance them on future retirees. He expressed the opinion that he thought that would be set aside by the courts. I also want to point out that the bill does require some adjustment of COLA increases for those people, and under Mr. Gary's approach goes all the way back to people who retired in 1996. Now, I would suggest to you that was long before anybody, that was even before Mr. Gary's clients began complaining about the PERS system. So I would question, first of all, I think there are great legal difficulties in going back enough, taking benefits from retirees, but to go all the way back to 1996, almost 7 years ago, and suggest that people who left the system that long ago should have their benefits somehow adjusted, again, I think is going to cause you problems in the contract area. And the final area I want to discuss, and I will be very, very brief, is there is a portion of the bill which amends the current PERS reserving statutes. Now, the current statutes, 238-670, sub 1, 2, 3, and 4, are some of the most obtuse, ambiguous, difficult to understand, and I can say that because they were all passed back in the 40s and 50s, and so none of us are responsible for them. But if you went back and looked at what we spent more time arguing about in litigation, it was arguing about the meaning of those statutes. Now, Judge Lipscomb did express his opinion about the meaning of some of the statutes. I don't find his opinion to be any clearer than the statutes that we started with. And so I would suggest that there is an opportunity for this body to go back and say, what are the appropriate reserving statutes that we need in a system like PERS? And I think the coalition, the PERS coalition, could support that. That's not what this bill does. What this bill does is simply make an attempt to redirect the income of the fund, income which is earned in part by employee monies in the fund, and redirect it to pay expenses which are currently paid by employers as the system currently exists. In other words, this is not a cleaning up the reserves statute. This is simply a mechanism for redirecting cash flow to the benefit of employers within the system. So we would oppose it. We think that's an area that does need study, and we think that's an area where the legislature could act and perhaps should act. And it may be that as a result of that action, it may have some impact on employee benefits down the road. But I think as long as the legislature were truly trying to rationalize the reserves of the system, I don't think there'd be any significant problem with that. But again, this bill doesn't do that. I see it as simply redirecting income in a way which is to advantage of employers within the system, and so by definition, to the disadvantage of employees within the system. Again, thank you. I will be sending some written comments because there are many other complexities to the bill, but I just wanted to hit the highlights, which coincidentally happen to be much the same that Mr. Gary did.
Thank you. Greg, I have a question. I think what we'll do is just ask questions of Mr. Hartman and then bring Mr. Gary back up since Mr. Hartman's here. The governor seemed to indicate some interest in this bill, and clearly he was most recently a Supreme Court justice, and he, I think he even indicated in his remarks about PERS that Bill Gary was going to win. And I recognize he's no longer on the Supreme Court. But, I mean, do you have any reason to... Why do you think he would think this is constitutional when Chamoff and yourself obviously don't believe that this remedy is constitutional? Yeah, he was sitting there in the Supreme Court a little more than a year ago, so...
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have never had the opportunity to have that direct discussion with the governor, so I don't know specifically what his thinking is. I would point out that he did not participate in any of the decisions that at least took place in the 90s, which would be the basis, I think, for challenge to these statutes. So he simply wasn't on the court at that time. Coincidentally, Mr. Chamoff and I both participated in aspects of those, since he reminded me not long ago that he defended the Measure 8 cases in the trial court unsuccessfully. I had forgotten that Greg was involved in those. You know, one of the things, and I'm glad you asked this, because I have heard it said there are different judges on the Supreme Court than were there the last time this kind of issue came up. And I am completely puzzled by that comment, because I think if you talk to any attorney, you will see that the identity of who's on the court is not the guiding principle behind how cases are going to be resolved, particularly in this area where we have a well-developed body of law, and a well-developed body of law which is protected both by the state and federal constitution, because remember, contract rights cannot be impaired under either constitution. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that the identity of the judges doesn't make any difference. Of course it does. You know, every judge brings to the table their own thoughts, prejudices, and so forth and so on. But I have to go back to the law as it currently exists and say to you that under the law as it currently exists, and it's been pretty clearly articulated over the last, really not just the last decade, but going back to the Taylor against Multnomah County case in the early 70s, we have a long line of cases that have followed a very consistent pattern of protecting benefits. So I'm as puzzled as everyone else when I hear things like Governor Kulongowski believes that the court might rule some other way. I can't explain that. I'd love to have the one-on-one discussion with him, but I don't know whether either one of us will have the opportunity to do that.
You indicated that you think the savings from this bill
will be far less because the employee contribution would be pulled out and it would be completely employer funded. Can you expand on that line of thinking a little bit?
Sure. Currently, the plan is funded by a 6% employee contribution, an employer contribution, which is adjusted from time to time and calculated by the actuary, and, of course, most important, earnings, because, as a matter of fact, in most pension plans, not been true the last couple of years, earnings are actually the greatest source of revenue coming into a plan. If the 6% solution were adopted, and by that I mean we simply ceased the employee contribution, I think this does it in two steps, but it doesn't make any difference, it would cease. You are taking away one of the sources of contribution which goes into funding the overall benefit. Now that has two impacts. Over time, it makes the money match benefit less powerful, because if you're not putting money in that can grow and increase the size of your account, over time, that will become an insignificant benefit. It will essentially disappear. But remember, the full formula benefit, the 1.67% times years of service times final average salary, is now going to be a benefit which is fully funded by employer contributions. In other words, we no longer have the flow of employee money in there to help shore up that benefit. So what happens is a couple of things. Your unfunded liability goes down substantially, but there's a trade-off because now the employer is the sole funding source for the full formula benefit. And so that's why you have a relatively large savings in unfunded liability, and I don't remember there, it is substantial. It's in Mr. Johnson's material. And yet the impact on employer rates seems to be much more modest than you would expect. And that's why, because you're saving on one side, but you're increasing the obligation of the employer on the other side. When you balance those two out, you're only saving about, according to Mr. Johnson, about 1.19% of payroll. The other thing that happens is we now have this 6% employee contribution, which is out there. It's unclear. I mean, all this bill does is say we're going to open up all the collective bargaining agreements. But we don't know what's going to happen to the 6%. If employers are successful in capturing it somehow, then obviously there are more savings. But that's an altogether, that would be a discussion that would keep us busy all afternoon, just that aspect of the bill and what's going to happen with that 6%. So that's why I'm saying it is a peculiar proposal, because it does many things. And it does, as I said, it does create winners and losers down the road among current PERS participants, particularly those who are Tier 2, I think may like this proposal, frankly. Those who are Tier 1, particularly those who are 10 and 15 years into their career, are quite frankly devastated by this proposal because their projected benefit, which right now is projected to be money match, becomes a full formula benefit, much, much less than they would have anticipated earning if the system does not change.
Obviously, opening up the contracts was an issue for you. Is there any simplified way to state what legal problems you think there might be with that aspect of this?
I see two problems. Number one, a statute which merely reopens collectively bargained agreements, which are contracts, I think constitutes an impairment of contract, and we can't find any way around that. So in other words, I think even if the legislature passes this, for instance, as it currently reads, I think you would immediately be met with a objection that you cannot do that. But the other problem is, remember, there are many, many participants in PERS who are not subject to collective bargaining contracts. And so the question is, what do you do with those folks? Because if you simply go to them, for instance, and say, I'm sorry, we're going to take back the 6%, you then become looking very much like what happened, despite what Mr. Gary says, very much like what happened in Measure 8. And so, again, you have problems with how you deal with the collective bargaining folks, but you have many, many folks out there who are not part of collective bargaining. How are you going to deal with those people? And if you simply let them keep the 6%, you say, fine, you keep your 6% or whatever, That doesn't fully solve your problem because you still have a contract issue, but again, your savings now are simply the 1.19%. There's no extra savings to employers because that 6% is simply going to some other employee use. It's going in their pocket. It's going to a 401k plan. It's going somewhere else. It's not being recaptured by the employer.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a series of questions, but I think they're probably best directed to Mr. Gary, at least initially.
Okay. Any other questions for...
I'll hang around.
For Attorney Hartman? No? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bill, you want to come back up?
Oh, by the way, if my bill did call to my attention, and I do want to call the committee's attention, there is a typo on my last page. And perhaps it was just wishful thinking, but I put in there that in discussing the reserving statutes that the proposal uses reserves as a conduit to redirect earnings to the benefit of an, I said employees, which I said is probably wishful thinking. That should say employers.
Okay.
So I apologize, and I meant to bring that to your attention, and I thank Mr. Gary who brought it to my attention.
Thank you.
Always happy to point out your mistakes.
At least quick. So.
I think you guys have way too much fun with this.
And so are we, Mr. Chair.
It must be the hourly rate that makes you happy. I
Do I get brief rebuttal?
If you wish.
I'm only going to say a couple of things, and then I do want to field your questions. Mr. Hartman said, I don't think this bill gets you where you want to go, and I can't resist pointing out that Mr. Hartman's job is to tell you that no bill will get you where you want to go. His position, and I think he stated it in so many words, is that anything that you do that has the effect of reducing projected benefits is illegal because it's a breach of contract. And if that's the case, then we might as well all go home now, because you cannot save money in the PERS system without reining in projected future benefits. And that's certainly what this bill does. Little savings for big risk. Obviously, Greg and I disagree about the degree of risk, but I want to point out that if you think about this in terms of the cost of the system rather than who is paying, because ultimately it is the taxpayers who are paying the full bill in the form of payroll to their employees. This proposal, the elimination of the 6% contribution, would not only reduce the unfunded actuarial liability immediately, overnight, by almost $2 billion, but it would reduce the cost of the system by 6.98% of payroll. 6.98% of payroll equals about $436.5 million per year. Now, it's true that the 6% of that 6.98% is the employee's contribution. The state of Oregon pays that along with a number of other employers. But the fact remains that over the long term, if you take the employee contribution out of the system, it will reduce the future cost of the system. And reducing the future cost of the system is what this whole exercise is about. What if the judge is wrong? And by the way, let's not forget when we're talking about these numbers, how big the numbers are. 1% of payroll to the school districts equals about $20 million per year. So these are not small numbers, even, you know, though we all become callous when we're talking about billions and say, well, it's only 1%. What if the judge is wrong? And I took the thrust of what Greg was saying to be, really, you need to let this play itself out because this is very complicated. And I don't think anybody would deny that this is very complicated, but I think that's the reason why the legislature needs to become involved, and the sooner the better. And Mr. Hartman knows as well as anyone that this is not unprecedented. There's a bill called House Bill 3349 that was passed a few years back dealing with the problems that arose when the legislature decided to tax retirement benefits, and the Supreme Court said you can't do that. And that, too, was the legislature prescribing a remedy for a big mistake. And that's all that this bill does. On reserving, and I'm happy to talk in greater detail about the reserving statutes, I just want to say two things. Number one,
This body's already taken care of to a large extent with regard to Tier 1, anything dealing with reserving, because you've said that they'll never get more than the guaranteed rate of return. And number two, no money in the PERS system accrues to the benefit of employers, ever. It is all being held for the benefit of employees, and the question is, what's the prudent way to manage that money to make sure that there's money there to pay member benefits when the time comes? And finally, I've been an appellate lawyer for about 25 years. I've handled lots and lots of cases in the Supreme Court, and anybody that gets up here and tells you that as an appellate lawyer they're not concerned with who's on the court and isn't in the business of counting votes is trying to sell you a bill of goods. Because we all do that, and we all know that just like the votes in this body vary by the personalities of the people that hold the office, the votes on the Supreme Court do, too. The Ospola case was decided by a 4-3 margin. And one last thing, whatever Governor Kulongoski's assessment of the merits may be, Greg is wrong when he says that he wasn't involved in the Measure 8 case. He was the Attorney General who handled the case defending Measure 8. And lost the case, and he's reminded me on occasion that he still has the scars to prove it.
Bill, you know, it's interesting that you bring forward House Bill 2003 as a remedy. In statute, I mean, people have talked about this 238.600 sub 2. If the public employee's retirement system is terminated or if contributions may no longer be made to the system, each member of the system has a non-forfeitable right to the benefits that the member has accrued to date. And it goes on to talk about the contributions may no longer be made to the system. Clearly, termination of the system was contemplated at some point. Why didn't you go there as opposed to go to a solution that involves just removing employee contributions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, termination is an option that not only has the legislature considered in prior sessions, but something that we look very carefully at as well. And I believe that it is an option worthy of consideration. However, in our judgment, you get most of the way there through House Bill 2003 by correcting the practices that were driving up the cost of the system and by eventually scaling back gradually the money match. The difficulty with terminating the system is the fight that you will have to confront over how you define accrued rights to protect those rights as the statute and I believe the court would require that we do. And I know that while Mr. Hartman and I disagree about many things, we would have a bloody good fight over what the accrued rights are and how you define them. The House Bill 2003, and in particular the 6% solution, eliminates that fight because it protects whatever members have as of today. And changes the system really to a defined benefit plan on a going forward basis.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Mr. Gary, this bill is a complicated bill, as everyone I think has observed, and it has a number of things in it, some of which neither of you have spoken to, and which address points that we have already dealt with in other legislation. I'm thinking particularly of the makeup of the PERS board and the mortality tables. This bill in the mortality provisions calls for a retroactive adjustment to new mortality tables back to the first of this year with no look-back provision. And as you, I'm sure, are aware, in House Bill 2004, we included a prospective effective date and look-back protection for people who are in the system now. Are you, in bringing this bill to us, urging that we should remake that decision to a more aggressive kind of a strategy as is outlined in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, first of all, let me say, although I prefer the strategy of a comprehensive bill, I have no particular quarrel with the decisions that this board has made with regard to composition and those sorts of things. On mortality tables, what I have told the Senate committee is that while we certainly believe that House Bill 2004 is moving in the right direction, it is from compared to current practices of the PERS board, it is not fully going as far as we think the judgment that we won in the Lipscomb case takes us, and specifically we would prefer to see an earlier implementation date, although that's not a particular import to us, but we do oppose the look back. And so whether it's in House Bill 2004 or in this bill, we still advocate the full and immediate adoption of mortality tables.
And I'll go forward, Mr. Chair, but if at some point you want to give somebody else an opportunity to weigh in, but just break in on me. The area of the bill that addresses the issues in the litigation and attempts to resolve them by creating a reserve fund that is then not to be paid for by employers but by employees has me just a little bit baffled. I think of the PERS system as kind of as a closed system, as I think was observed in the testimony, where there are only certain sources from which amounts that have been paid out in error, as asserted in that litigation, can be recovered, and employer contributions is certainly one of those. Earnings is another, which is identified here in the bill. But earnings only affect member benefits to the extent that they're controlled by the money match formula, and yet the one of the major features of this bill is to try to make the money match subside so that it is overtaken by the full formula benefit, at which point reductions in earnings would, as a general matter, not affect the members. So where does the correction of those errors come from if it doesn't get borne by the employers?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, several responses to that. And first of all, I'm not sure whether you misspoke or whether I need to clarify one aspect of the bill, because you said that the adjustment is not to be paid by employers but by employees, and in fact it is, as I think you recognize, to be paid out of future earnings, and insofar as those earnings without the adjustment would be available for crediting, then it affects employer accounts and employee accounts alike. So I would disagree that that the brunt of the adjustment is borne by the employees, but I think you do understand that it is the adjustment properly as being paid out of future earnings. And you're also correct that over time, a member who retires under the full formula benefit, the amount that's in their account is of no moment. The only reason that a account would matter to an employee who ultimately will retire under a full formula is if they leave the PERS system before retirement and cash out. But as I've said, the time that it will take House Bill 2003 to bring most PERS members under the full formula is it's going to take some years to do that. And in the meantime, the payment of the costs of the errors identified by the court out of future earnings will drive down the assumed earnings rate for Tier 1 member accounts and will reduce the obligations of what PERS calls the employer accounts, because to the extent that those benefits are covered by the future earnings, they will not have to be paid out of the employer, out of the reserves that are called employer accounts.
I understood your indication earlier that this would bring the assumed interest rate of the system down from 8% to 7%, which means, because the statute only requires the assumed interest rate to be credited, that would reduce what's credited to member accounts. Do you contemplate anything less than that 7% rate being credited so that there's a makeup in effect coming out of member accounts that way, or is it only that effect of reducing the assumed interest rate from 8 to 7 that would one would recover it from tier one accounts that are in the regular account investment option?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, in light of the bill that the governor signed that caps the earnings on tier one accounts at the assumed rate as to tier one accounts, this bill, the only effect on tier one accounts would be to reduce the assumed earnings rate and therefore reduce the crediting for the period of time that it takes to earn at the deficit account. But it also has an impact on tier two accounts because the actual earnings that would be available for crediting to member account, tier two member accounts, would be reduced by the netting out of the deficit account.
So it would have a I think it might have a disproportionate effect on, say, tier two accounts who are not, because theirs is not subject to an assumed interest rate floor, so it would hit those accounts maybe disproportionately harder than it would hit tier one accounts?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I don't think it would be disproportionate. I think that the impact on tier two accounts would probably vary more by year to year based upon actual earnings. But in effect, what you're doing is taking money off of the top. And this will only work in years when the earnings are on the positive side, and really only work in years when the earnings are at least the assumed rate. Otherwise, it will have no effect on Tier 1 accounts. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that the Tier 2 accounts are exposed in every year, whereas Tier 1 accounts are only exposed in years where the assumed rate, where the fund earns at least 7%, I think you could characterize that as having a disproportionate impact on Tier 2, but the truth of the matter is that the impact on either Tier 1 or Tier 2 accounts is actually fairly modest and not unprecedented, given the fact that the statutes currently provide that the first thing you do out of earnings is pay expenses of the fund, and the second thing you do out of earnings is set aside contingency reserves to deal with unforeseen consequences.
I'm going to abandon that line of question, but I would mention that this is, I think, subject matter that we need probably more detailed input on, because I'd say it's an aspect of this bill that I think I'm quite uncertain about myself. I want to shift over to the 6% solution feature of the bill. Mr. Hartman has described it as being a savings of 1.19% of payroll for employers, although he did indicate that he explained it, that because the 6% is itself would be then the subject of collective bargaining under reopening open to bargaining agreements under the bill, that would be open to negotiation. Is this solution being advanced in by the employers in the expectation that they're going to recover some or all of that 6% in that process? Is this like what the kind of bargaining strategy that I think has been attributed to the old Soviet Union, that what's mine is mine and what's yours is negotiable?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I don't speak for all employers and what position they would take at the bargaining table, but there's quite a bit less mystery around and certainly less insidious motives around the suggestion that the employees and the employers sit down and talk about what to do with that 6% than I think Mr. Hartman reads into it. Our goal was to reduce the cost of the system, and our focus has been on reducing system costs. Employee salaries and other benefits change over time, and as everybody is painfully aware, right now there's not a lot to negotiate about because there isn't very much money either at the state or the local level. One of the side effects of this bill is that there would be something to talk about. There is now a 6%, at least in those jurisdictions where the employer has been picking up the contribution. And our expectation is that employees and employers would talk about ways to
deal with that. It may go into salary increases. It may go into other kinds of tax-free, tax-deferred benefits, such as a health savings account or a supplemental defined contribution plan. The bill and the position of the employer supporting the bill is not contingent upon our something that we have up our sleeve to snooker employees out of that 6%. The idea behind the bill as it's written that says that it will reopen negotiations is, as I said, where employers have entered into agreements with the understanding that employees have an obligation to pay 6% of their income to fund a retirement plan, when that obligation goes away, circumstances change. And those changed circumstances are exactly the kind of circumstances where any parties to a contract say, let's sit down and talk about it. If I had a contract with you that said, I will make your house payment, and for some reason your obligation to pay your house payment went away, that would not mean that I had an obligation automatically to continue paying you the amount of money that I was paying. It would mean that circumstances had changed and we would need to sit down and talk about what was the fair thing to do in light of those changed circumstances. And that's really all this bill does.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll yield to other members of the committee.
Questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gary, I want to make sure that I understand the big picture because there's a tendency to get kind of buried in minutia. My understanding that what you're attempting with House Bill 2003 is to bring back the current aberration that's become the PERS system to an original intention that people would retire with the full formula benefit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that's exactly right. And I would add to that that the intent of the bill is to do that in a gradual way rather than in a precipitous way that will be sensitive to the fact that our employees, all of the public's employees, have very significant interests that are affected by the errors that brought us to where we sit. And we are trying to be sensitive to those settled expectations in ways that will produce the savings that I think we need to produce in order to keep the ship afloat, but to do so in a way that is not unfair to our employees.
May I continue?
Paul?
In your the introductory part of the bill, you mentioned that as of year 2000, there was an estimate that PERS retirees as of that time were averaging about 106% of their final average salary. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you know where those numbers would be today as compared to what they were 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago?
I suspect, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that there is someone from PERS more qualified to answer that question than me. What I can tell you is two things that I have seen. Estimates that before the bubble that we're dealing with now of extraordinary benefits subsides, that figure may rise over the next several years to as much as 124% of final average salary. And that is before Social Security benefits. And that number itself, the way that PERS calculates the replacement ratio, I think is a little bit distorted if what you're trying to find out is what the actual spending power of the retiree will be. And the reason I say that is because in calculating the pre-retirement income of a member, they take into account the 6% contribution to the PERS system, which of course, regardless of who's paying, it is not available to the employee to spend as income. And in calculating the post-retirement income, they do not count the House Bill 3349 adjustment that is made for members to compensate them for the fact that their benefits are now subject to taxation. And those two things combined is a little bit more than a 15% swing in terms of looking at the actual replacement ratios that members receive.
Follow up?
Obviously, it's not the intention of the legislature or the employers to provide 125% of final income retire final salary on an ongoing basis, nor could that be afforded. And we understand that this is an aberration that has not been caused by the employees, the PERS members, but it's something that still has to be dealt with. And so we know something has to be done. We know it has to be brought back into a reasonable and predictable and affordable level. But I have some concern with what Mr. Hartman said about the possibility that if this bill is passed and then it goes down, that the 6%, which according to the bill's terms could no longer be paid by the employee, would have to be made up by the employers. And yes, the taxpayer is going to pay it, but that 6% is going to get paid one way or another in all likelihood. And so is there a possibility that if this plan is held to be unconstitutional because of a contract provision, that the employers will have to make up that 6% and all accrued interest and all the other ramifications of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it's a little difficult to predict all of the potential outcomes. I personally think that's an unlikely outcome, not only because I think that the changing, the elimination of the requirement of the 6% contribution on a going forward basis is not likely to be overturned, but because the bill provides for an expedited process to have this matter resolved as quickly as possible. And really part of the design of the bill is to put this issue, that is the solution to the problem, before the court at the same time that the court considers the case that deals with the problem itself, the City of Eugene case. And I think that while you know no solution is going to be risk-free, there is not a significant risk that will be terribly far down the road if this bill passes before you have word from the Supreme Court about what the challenges, what the outcome of the challenges.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned before, we all know that something has to be done. We see as it's boiling down that the alternatives are somewhat limited. One of them is termination of the plan. And you've said that you agree with Mr. Hartman that there would be difficulty in defining or dealing with the accrued benefit levels and that kind of thing. I'm confused. Supposing that there was a determination, and I'm not saying that this is supported, but that it was decided that there was going to be a day and time that there would be a change, what is the confusion, the difficulty in determining what accrued benefits would have been earned as of some date in on the calendar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'll give you one example, and there are many. In the discussions around House Bill 2004 dealing with mortality tables, the PERS Coalition took the position that they had a contract right to have the use of outdated mortality tables, and that the only way that you could avoid breaching a contract was to have not just a look-back provision such as the one that this body adopted, but a look-back with interest. And as I understand the way that mechanism would work, you get not only the value of your account balance today, but the value, the projected value of your account balance at the time of your retirement with all of the interest that you would earn on that account balance. It's those kinds of issues that I think would have to be sorted out that you know simply are not presented by this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Understanding that this is not your position, but also understanding that lawyers are adept at seeing the other side, I'd like you to address why you think Mr. Chamoff can so clearly conclude in his memo that House Bill 2003 does constitute material breach in contract rights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I would welcome the opportunity to do that. Unfortunately, I didn't know that there was such an opinion until I heard it from Mr. Hartman this afternoon when he testified. And without the opportunity to look at his opinion, I really would hesitate to offer criticisms of it, although I'm quite certain that with the opportunity to review it, I will be able to do that, and I'll provide that to you.
Well, actually, I didn't know that the opinion existed either until I
arrived today and sat sitting here. I have had a chance to talk with our legal counsel on numerous occasions, and he has taken the position that we can't change anything to the PERS system, and has made that pretty clear from the very beginning, and has issued legal opinions pretty much on every bill. And as someone suggested, we might as well turn the lights off and go home if that is what the Supreme Court ultimately is going to decide. But I think we still need to ask the questions and give them to the court in order for them to make that determination, because clearly Mr. Chamoff is not on the Supreme Court and has never been on the Supreme Court. So it is his legal opinion, but I think he's basing that on the last couple of cases and the fact that he was participated in those and ended up losing, and that is what he's issuing the opinions on. But I don't know that we should take that to mean that we shouldn't move forward on anything, because we clearly have moved forward on three bills. I think at least one of which he also suggested was likely unconstitutional, and I believe that was the mortality table issue.
Can I follow up on that?
You bet.
Thank you. I thought you had a copy of it, since it was on our desks as well, and I certainly welcome the opportunity, if it comes up again, to hear your opinion.
I look forward to reading it.
But assuming for the moment that he ends up being right, if not 100% right, at least right in some material way, how would your clients propose that we recoup the repayment or the damages that end up having to be assessed if the Eugene decision is overturned, as I said, in some material way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, are you asking about whether if the Eugene decision is overturned or if House Bill 2003 is invalidated in some way?
Well, I link the two. If we proceed with 2003 implementing the Eugene decision and it ends up not being upheld in some material fashion, and there are reimbursements that have to be made, damages that have to be paid, somebody has to pay to make the employees whole, how would you suggest we collect the money to do that? Who should pay that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, fortunately, I guess a couple of preliminary comments. First of all, with respect to the Lipscomb decision, this bill really does two things. It first of all, tells the board that as Judge Lipscomb did, they are directed in the future to conform their conduct to the law as it was interpreted by Judge Lipscomb. And that, I think, that provision falls into the category that Mr. Hartman was talking about, where you can weigh in and say, no, we think you've got it wrong, or in this case, we think you've got it right. So if you think that the board should be using current mortality tables and that they ought to be setting aside the reserves statutes direct and that they ought not to be imprudently crediting member accounts, and you agree that 20% in 1999 was imprudent, the passage of this bill will take those issues off the table in the future. That is, that will make it the law, even if the court ultimately says Judge Lipscomb was wrong, that wasn't the law before. The real problem comes down to the money. And if the court were to reverse Judge Lipscomb's decision in any particular, then the costs associated with the part of the decision that got overturned would be backed out of the Lipscomb adjustment, and it would not be... it just wouldn't be factored in. If by some odd chance Mr. Hartman is entirely successful and the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals says we have no idea what Judge Lipscomb was talking about, there's no problem here, then we are back to square one, and the statutes already provide that the employers pay the cost of the system other than the employee's 6% contribution, and we will have simply lost our case. So the one final thing that I want to say, and this is a topic of ongoing discussion among the lawyers,
As you know, it's been several months since Judge Lipscomb decided that benefits were being paid unlawfully and excessively, and thus far the PERS board has done nothing to change its practices. So when somebody retires today, they are still receiving the benefits that Judge Lipscomb said were excessive. It's our view that the more prudent course is to tell members, under Judge Lipscomb's decision, this is the amount of the benefit. Now, the case is on appeal, and we may owe you more money if you lose, but I think it is much easier to pay members more money if we lose than it is to pay them more money under the current circumstances and then put PERS in the position where they have to try to go recoup those excess payments. And so, I personally favor immediate implementation of the judgment while the case is on appeal, because I think that is the prudent course. And I think that members would be well advised to make their decisions about whether to retire or not on the assumption that the decision will be upheld, rather than assuming that somehow they're going to continue to receive the elevated benefits.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Greg, can you come back up? I wanted to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Geary regarding 238.600. You probably spent a lot of time with these statutes, and clearly, the current law, it contemplates termination of the system. Can we do that?
No.
So we can't terminate the system.
My recollection, and don't hold me to the precise date, but my recollection is that statute was passed in about 1996 or 98 or thereabouts, sometime in the latter 90s. And I think if you go back and find out why that statute's there, it was motivated by tax counsel from PERS who said there needs to be a provision in this statute in order to protect the continued qualification of the plan, and that basically has to be a statute that says something like this. As a matter of fact, the language of the statute is really private sector language, the accrued benefit language. So I believe that statute was inserted, as I say, in the latter 90s to basically assure the continued qualification of the plan. I think if you go back and look at the history of it, I don't think the belief was that it was somehow taking or creating a right to terminate the plan. Now, do people who joined PERS after 1998 or 96, whenever that was passed, are they perhaps in a situation where they could be terminated? That might be a little different, but that's different from terminating the whole plan, because, of course, most of the people in the plan were there long before 96 and 98. So if the legislature didn't have the right to terminate it before 96 or 98, they couldn't have created it then, and now can't go back to that statute and say, see, we can terminate it because a few years ago we put the statute in. So I think the statute has less utility than one might suppose. That's my recollection of where the statute came from. And I do agree with Bill Geary, at least to this extent, that because particularly the use of that term, accrued benefits, which is a private sector term, the termination of PERS, were you to terminate it today, I believe you would still be required to continue to pay the money match benefit, in effect, and continue the 8% guarantee for all the monies that are currently in the system, because that's what accrued benefits means in that. Now, Mr. Geary may disagree with me. As he said, we'd probably have quite a fight over that, but again, I think that statute is there for a very specific purpose and not meant to suggest that suddenly the legislature had the chance or the right to terminate the system.
But we can start a new plan for new hires.
Absolutely. So we agree. Thank you very much.
I want to make sure. Anything else for Mr. Hartman?
I have one question.
Before we do that, just so I don't forget, because Kara's reminding me for the third time, the Oregon State Firefighters Council has submitted written testimony. It's on your desk, and she'll be entered into the record.
No, hold it. Yeah.
Representative Richardson?
I'll hold it.
Do you want to hold your question? Okay. My intent is to have more testimony on this bill on Thursday. I think likely the way I'll handle it is 20 minutes of invited testimony from both sides and 20 minutes of public testimony, because I know The employer side wanted to bring a few folks down, and my guess is the employee side would be happy to continue to elaborate their position, or should I say opposition, for the bill. And I'm sure that there'll be other folks from the public who would want to speak on it. I also want to take up House Bill, the successor plan bills. I hope that we will have a report one way or the other on Thursday as it relates to those. And I want to open a public hearing on the House Bill 2407, since it's on our calendar. Colleagues, this is a bill to remove legislators from PERS, put them into another plan. It is my intent to move a bill this week or next relating to removing legislators from PERS. The one thing that the employers and the employees seem to agree on is that legislators shouldn't be in their new plan. And I've agreed with that since I came into service here, that the legislature should not be in a system that it oversees and makes changes to, because I think there's an inherent conflict of interest. So I would appreciate your input as to whether we should make room for a system for legislators to retire under, or if we should just have no system whatsoever. I'm happy to do what the committee decides they want to do, but it is my intent to move a bill through this legislature and have a vote on this particular bill. I'm seeking amendments to this bill because I believe that the administration of that should also be outside of any budget that we oversee, and therefore I would suggest that the PERS agency shouldn't oversee the legislator's plan, and that it should be administered privately if there is going to be a plan. So with those suggestions, I'd be happy to take your input in the next couple of days as to what you'd all like to see, and look forward to moving a bill likely next week. But if we were so fortunate as to have a fairly unanimous agreement on where we're headed by Thursday, and the legislative council could accommodate, I'd be happy to move a bill taking legislators out of PERS by then. But I don't anticipate that we'll be on that quick of a timeline. Does anybody have any recommendations before we close the public hearing? I don't think anybody was signed up to testify on this. So,
Mr. Chair, I would just offer some comments. First of all, an observation. I actually have no stake in this issue because I declined to participate in the PERS system because elected officials are given that option, and I chose not to because of my service on this committee and because I have a retirement from another source. But I think that it raises sort of long-term issues about how we relate to people who make a substantial commitment to public service. And I'm open to input from other committee members, and wondering whether maybe just taking away the additional value of benefit that the members of the legislature get now by being classed along with public safety people at a faster multiplier might be sufficient to alleviate the concerns of the public that the decisions are being affected by their own self-interest. So just a general observation I would throw out for consideration among other committee members.
Thank you. Representative Barker?
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair. I have a bill in which you may have seen that would begin this process with the freshman class of this legislature rather than the next one, as this bill does. In other words, persons like myself would not be in PERS.
You know, it starts with your class?
Yeah.
Why start with your class? Let's include everybody.
I don't know how the same problems some of these other people have, the contractual rights and everything, and it only takes one person to sue them now.
It would be an interesting lawsuit. It seems to me that our contract is renewed every 2 years or every 4 years by the electorate. So I don't know how far that extends, but I think that would be an interesting lawsuit. Maybe we can hire Mr. Hartman here for those of us who maybe agree.
I can testify he works for very reasonable rates.
So he'll probably be passing out cards as we go to work session. But We may want to extend it beyond the freshman class. Representative Nolan.
I appreciate that you're bringing this forward. I think this is an important issue for us to deal with. I also, at the request of one of my constituents, filed a bill addressing this issue. So I'm anxious for us to move forward on making a proposal, passing a bill.
I will. We'll look at your bill numbers and put them all on the calendar then for public hearing and possible work session, just so we cover everybody. I think the PERS committee put this particular bill in, didn't we?
Yes.
And so I'm happy to use any of them as a vehicle, but I do want to move forward on a bill. So I look forward to everybody's input as to what that should look like. But my thought was that if we're going to have a new system, legislators ought to go first. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2407. If there's nothing for the good of the order, we'll adjourn committee. Thank you, committee members.